Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. It is my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you here often. At this time, please turn off all cell phones and other noise-making devices. Now, here are some of our upcoming Health and Medicine Forum events. On March 19th, Pam Belloc, who's a New York Times reporter, will make a presentation on her new book, Island Practice, about a physician in a rural setting in New England. On March 20th, James Laval, MD, will speak about metabolic wellness. And on April 3rd or 4th at noon, I think we will have Kevin Sabet speak on Project SAM, which is Smart Approaches to Marijuana, and hopefully get Clint Verner to debate him. So it could be an interesting program if we pull it off. These are just three of our many upcoming programs, and I invite you to check our website for a complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online at www.commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. Questions can be asked today using a portable microphone, which I will pass around after the remarks by our speaker. By the way, he has a book called Smoke Signals, which will be for sale in the library both before and after the meeting. It's not the subject of this particular talk, but it's a book worth having nonetheless. Okay, now I'll begin the program for the official recording. Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Martin A. Lee. Martin A. Lee is an American author and activist who has written books and articles on far-right movements, terrorism, media issues, and drug politics. Mr. Lee has an undergraduate degree in philosophy from the University of Michigan. He has been a guest teacher in residence at the University of Illinois and has lectured at many colleges and universities, including Harvard University, Columbia University, Dartmouth College, Johns Hopkins University, and the American University of Paris. In 1994, he was given the Pope Foundation Award for Investigative Journalism. Lee was a co-founder of the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, a group formed in 1986 to combat corporate and establishment media bias. He was the first full-time editor of FAIR's magazine Extra and later served as the publication's publisher. Lee's first book, Acid Dreams, the CIA, LSD, and the 60s Rebellion, co-authored with Bruce Schlein, was published in 1985 by Grove Press, covering LSD's use by both the counterculture in the 60s and by the U.S. CIA in mind control experiments. Lee's second book, Unreliable Sources, A Guide to Detecting Bias in News Media, co-authored with Norman Solomon, was both a distillation and expansion of his work with FAIR. Lee's third book, The Beast Reawakens, An In-Depth Examination of the Resurgence of Fascism, was published by Little Brown in 1997. He and Fred Gardner, former editor of Scientific American and in the audience this evening, founded Project CBD as a nonprofit educational service dedicated to promoting and publicizing research into the medical utility of cannabidiol, CBD, and other components of the cannabis plant. It was conceived by two journalists who have been covering the medical marijuana movement industry in the past in the pages of O'Shaughnessy's, which was on the chair in the back. They think the reintroduction of CBD-rich cannabis into the grassroots supply warrants special focus. They support the Society of Cannabis Clinicians' effort to collect, aggregate, and publish data from patients to determine patterns of efficacy or lack of efficacy. His new book, Smoke Signals, recently received the American Botanical Council's James A. Duke Award for Excellence in Botanical Literature. And now, Martin Lee.
Thank you. I should emphasize right at the outset that I'm not a doctor and I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist. And I want to share with you some of what I learned while researching and writing Smoke Signals. Smoke Signals, as Bill Graham pointed out, is not exclusively about the topic of the lecture tonight, but there is an overlap there. Smoke Signals is a social history of marijuana. It's a history of cannabis told through various characters, including doctors and scientists and musicians and poets and many others. But the main character of the book is the plant itself. And I think one of the strangest things about marijuana is that still, after all these years, it's a subject of such controversy in our society. There's many conflicting claims that are made about marijuana, and as a result, there's a lot of confusion about it. For starters, on one hand, you have the federal government. Their official position is that marijuana is a dangerous drug with no medical value. To my mind, that's tantamount to saying the moon is made of green cheese. On the other hand, you have people singing the proponents singing the praises of marijuana, you know, claiming it's good for everything under the sun, that it can heal so many different conditions, that it's useful for practically everything but fixing the kitchen sink. It comes off as snake oil when people hear this. In terms of the confusion about marijuana, there's one area I want to talk about briefly before we get into the presentation at hand, and that is about medical science and the research going on. The federal government actually grows marijuana on a farm at the University of Mississippi, and it's meant to provide material for scientists to do research with. The problem is that it's nearly impossible for scientists and doctors to access the material to do clinical investigations. It's a peculiar situation you have in the United States. Nearly anyone can get marijuana if they try. It's very easy. It's ubiquitous. The only people who have a difficult time accessing it is scientists and doctors who want to do serious research. The government prevents that. So you have a kind of catch-22 at work. On the one hand, federal officials say, well, we just don't have enough data to validate marijuana's medical uses, if there are any. At the same time, they're preventing scientists and doctors from doing the research to acquire the data to assess it. Editorial writers have taken the federal government to task for this, critics of the policy of saying that this is there's something obviously amiss here. We need more research. The government should allow it to happen. But this criticism, I think, is somewhat misplaced and misleading, because whereas clinical research is prevented, is thwarted in the United States, there's an enormous amount of preclinical research that has gone on. Preclinical research is thriving, and by preclinical, I'm referring to animal studies, studies with molecules and test tubes and petri dishes, human cell lines, but not studies done on human subjects. That's very, very difficult to do in the United States, particularly with marijuana. You have a situation where there's an enormous amount of data that's been generated by preclinical studies. Probably in the last 25 years, some 20,000 pages have focused on cannabinoid science, looking at the compounds in the plant and their correlates in the human brain and body. And much of this research has been sponsored by the U.S. government, which sought to demonstrate why marijuana is harmful. That's why they funded this research. And the great irony, one of the greatest ironies of the marijuana story, is that the U.S. government has funded this research to document harm, but it instead ended up showing why it's therapeutic, ended up providing data that has, in essence, validated the experience of many medical marijuana patients. The cannabinoid science area is a very exciting and dynamic area of medical science today. It opened up whole new vistas of understanding in terms of with respect to mammalian biology and physiology. It has, and these have really breathtaking implications for many areas of medical science. So there is a lot of research, and I'm going to refer to it in the talk, but most of it is preclinical. There's some clinical studies, but most of the data that I'm going to be talking about is based on preclinical research. Now, among marijuana smokers, there is a tendency to equate marijuana with THC, the one compound, tetrahydrocannabinol, that's the main psychoactive compound. That's the compound that makes people feel high. There's also a tendency to equate marijuana with THC among drug warriors, among proponents of prohibition. And there's a reason for that, because there is a pill of pure THC that's available as a pharmaceutical. It's marketed under different names, slightly different versions of it. Pure THC pill, you can get it with a doctor's prescription. It's called Marinol. There's also Nabilene, Sesamit, 100% THC, basically. And the idea is that at least the opponents of marijuana legalization or medical marijuana legalization will say you don't need to legalize medical marijuana. The pill already exists. You can get it from with a doctor's prescription. And this is a fallacious argument because there's many more compounds, biologically active compounds, in marijuana than just THC. And I'm going to focus on one of those compounds in the talk tonight, and that's cannabidiol, CBD. And there's many reasons to focus on CBD. As you'll see, it's a very it's very exciting in terms of its therapeutic implications. But I choose to focus on it also as a reminder, as a way of emphasizing that there's more to marijuana than just THC. So I'm going to start now with the slides. And just to introduce CBD. Unlike THC, which is psychoactive, CBD is not psychoactive. It doesn't make a person feel high. And in fact, it can actually counter the psychoactivity of THC, depending how much of it is in a particular strain. You can have a strain with THC in it, but if there's enough CBD, a person won't feel high from consuming it. CBD tends to be the second most prominent cannabinoid or compound in the marijuana plant. THC is generally most dominant. CBD is usually second. These days, in what you'll get in most dispensaries or on the black market, the CBD is present only in very small amounts in marijuana. THC tends to be very dominant. There's over 100 different cannabinoids, these unique compounds that exist in the plant world only in marijuana. After THC and CBD, they exist in very, very minor quantities. But CBD also these days, it tends to be there only in a minimal amount. As you'll see, CBD has remarkable therapeutic potential. Its molecular structure was first elucidated and it was first synthesized in 1963 by Dr. Raphael Meshulam, an Israeli scientist. A couple of years later, his team in Israel also did the same for THC, where they elucidated the molecular structure of THC and also was able to synthesize it then. But in the early going, starting in the 60s, there was very little research into CBD. And that didn't pick up until the discovery of the receptors in the brain that respond pharmacologically to the cannabinoids, which only started in the late 80s. Before that, there was some research that went on in Brazil, a little bit in Israel, a little bit in the United States involved with CBD. There was some early work looking at CBD's effect on epilepsy. But for the most part, to the extent that research was focusing on cannabinoids, the focus tended to be on THC. And in general, at least in the pharmaceutical industry, the focus is usually in one compound at a time. It's a kind of a reductionist approach, but their studies will focus on one compound at a time, but not a lot on CBD until the discovery of what we call the endocannabinoid system. And one could spend 3 hours just talking about the information on this slide. I obviously can't do that, but just as a background, I wanted to go through. Endocannabinoid system. Endo is internal. It's referring to the receptors in the brain that respond pharmacologically to THC. It also, and think in terms of twos. Actually, let me step back. Think of it this way, because I know that there's different levels of understanding about the endocannabinoid system among the people in the audience, but think of when you went to high school studying biology and you learned about you had a skeletal system and a circulatory system and a nervous system and a reproductive system. You learned about these various systems. Well, the endocannabinoid system is a whole new system that was discovered starting in 1989, except it's not a new system. It's actually been evolving for close to 500 million years. It exists in every animal that has a spinal cord has an endocannabinoid system. But think in terms of twos. There's two cannabinoid receptors in the brain and body. I don't mean just two, but two sets of them. Cannabinoid 1, cannabinoid 2, CB1 and CB2. CB1 is concentrated in the brain and central nervous system. CB2 in the immune system, in the peripheral nervous system, the peripheral organs. Also, within us, we have two principal or primary endocannabinoids. In other words, we have compounds in our own body that are somewhat similar, not necessarily in molecular structure, but in terms of their effect, in that they bind to these cannabinoid receptors. And there's two principal ones. There's actually more than just two. But the two main ones are called anandamide and 2-AG. And what is the function of these receptors and these endocannabinoids that bind to these receptors? Well, what scientists have discovered, I will sum it up in three ways. Neuroprotection is a key function. Conceive of it as your first line of defense when you're exposed to a toxin. It's the endocannabinoid system that sort of kicks into gear to protect against that toxin. So neuroprotection, preventing the degeneration of nerves, nerve cells. Homeostasis, another key function. It provides balance in the body. When you are feeling stress, something has to bring you back to a normal level. When the immune system kicks into high gear to fight off a fever, well, something's got to turn down the temperature, or else you're going to be feverish for the rest of your life. It's the endocannabinoid system that actually provides that homeostatic function for many, many different physiological systems. And the other is what scientists refer to as buffering stress. It is the first line of stress against stress in the body. And there's a few abstracts that I just put on here. I don't know how easy it is to read, but just it illustrates what I said. I'm just going to read the titles and you get the gist. The role of the endocannabinoid system in the control of energy homeostasis. Next is the endocannabinoid system in the control of glucose homeostasis. And you could have 100 other examples of homeostasis in terms of physiological functions. And the last is endogenous cannabinoid signaling is essential for stress adaptation. These are all peer-reviewed journals. The latter is from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. So this is, you're talking about, your blue ribbon formed for science. I want to now turn specifically to CBD. This is from a study, and what I'm going to do here is basically run through fairly quickly a series of science abstracts. The cumulative effect of this, I think, is very, very powerful. But the first abstract is from 2011. This is Brazilian researchers who studied, and they do work with human subjects in Brazil. It's a lot easier there. And the conclusion of this study was that chronic use in high doses of CBD are well tolerated in humans. There are no known adverse side effects from CBD. The one side effect I heard from scientists is maybe dry mouth. And it seems that cannabinoids have an astringent effect, and they tend to dry the body. So with that established, I want to talk first about a CBD in cancer and to run through a couple of experiments that have been done by the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco. It's really doing the cutting-edge research in this area. And this is not only happening in the United States, incidentally. There's research into cannabinoids and cancer in many different countries. One section of smoke signals I ran through bullets of 15 different cancers, just taking illustrations from different academic centers around the world, various continents, of looking at the different cancers and how the cannabinoids have an effect of ameliorating the cancer, or at least, again, in preclinical research, thwarting the cancer, stopping the metastasis or whatever. The title of this abstract from California Pacific Medical Center from a report in September 2010, Pathways Mediating the Effects of Cannabidiol on the Reduction of Breast Cancer Cell Proliferation, Invasion, and Metastasis. As the title of the abstract indicates, when human cell lines that are kept alive of people who had breast cancer, either since passed away but they have the cell lines, they keep them alive and they work with them. When these cell lines are exposed to CBD, the cancer is thwarted. And they not only were able to establish that CBD can reduce proliferation, invasion, and metastasis of breast cancer cells, there was really a breakthrough in the research, and they established one of the mechanisms whereby this happens, and that is by silencing or turning off the ID1 gene. This is a gene that's, when it's expressed, it's very active when the embryo is forming during pregnancy, that ID1 gene is actively expressed. It's the time you need cells to be formed. But after birth, it turns off, and it's supposed to stay off. But later on, if one has certain kinds of cancer, then it's associated with being turned on again. The ID1 gene, it turns out, is implicated in several different aggressive cancers, about a dozen or so, prostate cancer, colon cancer, brain cancer as well. Interesting, when I first met Bill Grant, who introduced me, who's one of the world's experts, incidentally, on vitamin D, we were talking, and it turned out he was aware that the ID1 gene is also silenced by vitamin D. So it seemed that vitamin D in appropriate amounts would be good for as a preventive against cancer. And I would be very interested if there would ever be experiments on if you could combine vitamin D and CBD to see if there was what the relationship would be to have both of them together in terms of as an anti-cancer compound. This is a from the again California Pacific Medical Center. These two slides showing the before and after effects of breast cancer cells exposed to CBD. On the left, you'll see the dark blotches. There's more breast cancer cells. That's before CBD is administered. Afterwards, you see the difference. There's much less viability of these cells. Again, also from the California Pacific Medical Center, a report that was published also in 2010, and I'll read the title of the abstract: "Cannabidiol enhances the inhibitory effects of THC on human glioblastoma cell proliferation and survival." THC also has can inhibit cancer cell, and in this case for the glioblastoma, a very aggressive, deadly form of brain cancer, basically incurable, it was shown that when THC was administered, the cancer would be inhibited on the human cell lines. Same thing, CBD actually had a more potent anti-cancer effect. But when combined together, the THC and the CBD had most potent anti-cancer effect. And that's important to keep in mind, the synergistic relationship between not just CBD and THC, but the other components of the plant really makes it more potent in many ways therapeutically. So to run through some other conditions, CBD as an anticonvulsant. This from a journal in 2011. Cannabidiol exerts anticonvulsant effects in animal models of temporal lobe and partial seizures. This is an area that's showing to be effective in the real world, not just in petri dishes, not just with animals. This is in terms of anticonvulsant effects in epilepsy. The CBD extracts that are available in medical marijuana states now, including California, have been showing to be very effective, particularly for Dravet's syndrome. This is when young children, infants, have intractable epilepsy. They have many seizures every day. And it's a devastating illness, obviously both for the child and the parents. And there's no drugs that really control this. And I've heard several instances that when the infant is given CBD, and if they're then administered repeatedly, it just simply stops the seizures. It's really, I would say, near miraculous. And it's not just a couple of examples that we've heard of this. This is a buzz on the internet now for families dealing with this illness. And we hear from them at Project CBD from all over the world asking how they can get this thing. This really works, and it's very, very exciting. And I can't tell you, you know, what it's like to be embraced by somebody you don't know with tears in their eye. You saved my child's life, you know. It's an exciting area, and it's some of what is being researched, I think, now at Stanford. They're looking at effects of CBD on epilepsy. CBD and diabetes. And again, I'm going to run through these quickly. This is from a 2006 study in Israel. Cannabidiol lowers incidence of diabetes in non-obese diabetic mice. And what they do is, you know, they create animal models of diseases, or they induce a disease in mice or rats or other rodents. Half the animals will be exposed to CBD that have the disease, half won't be. The animals that have had the CBD administered have less incidence of the disease, in this case, diabetes. So this is in a very interesting area, an important area. CBD suppresses cardiac arrhythmia. This is from the British Journal of Pharmacology, 2010. Acute administration of CBD in vivo, meaning in a live animal, suppresses ischemia-induced cardiac arrhythmias and reduces infarct size when given at reperfusion. In other words, they induce a stroke in an animal, and then they, when they administer the CBD, the impact of the stroke is much less than compared to animals that haven't been given the CBD where the stroke has been administered. But quite significantly, it also stops the arrhythmic heartbeat that comes along with the stroke. And this is significant because for many reasons. But for one thing, in terms of the pharmaceutical world, there are no remedies for cardiac arrhythmia. And this is something that's increasingly common as people get older. Now, this is not as a result of strokes being induced, but this is a medical condition for which CBD shows some potential according to preclinical research. I should say, you know, just because something shows potential or shows effectiveness with a mouse doesn't necessarily translate to mean that it will show effectiveness for people. Sometimes experiments with mice can't be repeated with rats, you know, no less with people. However, it's a good clue as to what might be a good line of research, and oftentimes there is. It does translate into or could potentially into applicability for people. CBD as an antipsychotic. This work was done in Brazil, again, with dealing with people as subjects, April 2006, cannabidiol, a cannabis sativa constituent, as an antipsychotic drug. This is a very exciting area, and there's been actually studies that compare your first-line standard antipsychotic drugs that have a lot of pernicious side effects, you know, with CBD. They find CBD is just as effective as an antipsychotic agent, but without the side effects. CBD as an antibacterial agent. This is an area that I think is largely neglected, even within the medical marijuana community. This study was published in 2008 in the Journal of Natural Products, which is the publication of the American Chemical Society. So we're talking about a very mainstream journal here. And the conclusion that I will read in the article, cannabidiol showed potent activity against a variety of methicillin-resistant staph strains. That's MRSA. MRSA, this is the antibiotic-resistant bacteria. The World Health Organization has identified antibiotic-resistant bacteria or antibiotic-resistant germs as one of the major looming health crises for the 21st century. I think 18,000 people died from MRSA in the United States in 2011. It's mainly concentrated, it was mainly in prisons and hospitals, but now it's getting into the general population. And the problem here, it's been caused by the overuse of antibiotics. And there's just, you can go so far in terms of more, you know, stronger and stronger antibiotics. When you reach a point, it just, it's really past the point of no return. And the fact that not just CBD, but several cannabinoids, including THC, were shown to have very potent antibacterial effects. And this is another area, if it was just this alone, would make it well worth studying and putting attention to. CBD as an antioxidant. This is from a 2003 patent application that was approved by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It was based on research that was sponsored by the National Institute of Health. A paper was published by Aidan Hansen in 1998, which established that both CBD and THC, but in particular CBD, had very potent antioxidant effects. CBD was found to have greater antioxidant potency than vitamin C and vitamin E. And this is from the patent, and I'm quoting now, approved by the U.S. government now, which claims that marijuana has no medical value. And they're referring now to THC and CBD in this. Cannabinoids have been found to have antioxidant properties and are found to have particular application as neuroprotectants, for example, in limiting neurological damage following ischemic insults, such as stroke and trauma, or in the treatment of neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and HIV dementia. And, you know, it's quite astonishing that this is what the government acknowledges. On the one hand, on the other hand, we have a kind of schizophrenic relationship with these compounds, that maybe the CBD would help the psychosis. I don't know. Anyway, CBD as a neuroprotectant, and this one really, this is the one that really does it for me, this slide. Journal of Neuroscience, 2007. This was a French study. The abstract, or the title of the paper, non-psychoactive cannabidiol prevents prion accumulation and protects neurons against prion toxicity. Prion, that's mad cow. Prion is infectious neurological illnesses. You know, Alzheimer's, you can have it, but you can't give it to somebody. You know, mad cow or a prion illness is transmissible. Well, CBD was found in this study, a preclinical study, to stop the prion infection in every phase when it was tested. So this is, again, quite amazing. CBD neurogenic. It turns out one of the things that the endocannabinoid system does, that the cannabinoid receptors do, is regulate neurogenesis and regulate neuroplasticity. This is the creation of new brain cells, new stem cells in adults. And 30 years ago, scientists, the going thinking among scientists was the brain's hardwired. You have a trauma in the brain, you lose brain cells, well, that's it. You know, those cells are lost. Scientists look at it very differently these days, and neuroplasticity is the going concept. Well, it turns out that CBD promotes stem cell creation and neurogenesis, and this particular article that I'm citing that was composed by German scientists, Swiss scientists, and Mexican scientists refers to the pro-neurogenic effects of CBD. So that's another area, quite astonishing. To bring it even a step deeper here, CBD is found to modify gene expression. There is a study done in Israel, I think it was 20, actually, I cite the study, the next slide. It was in Israel 2010, this study was done, and what it involved is they select 24,000 different genes, and they expose different substances, the genes to different substances, and they found that CBD had a great capacity to modify gene expression, to turn gene expression on and off. So of the 24,000 genes that were studied in this particular research project, 1,204 gene transcripts were significantly regulated by CBD. That's what they found. 680 of the gene transcripts were upregulated, meaning they turned the expression on. 524 genes downregulated, the expression turned off. Like the ID1 gene I referred to earlier, that's involved with aggressive forms of cancer. Well, CBD doesn't just silence that gene; it does it for many others. And this obviously is just a selected group of genes. So it's potentially quite a few more, but THC was used in the same study, and it was found to modulate 94 different genes. So, you know, when you hear critics of medical marijuana talk about how, well, you know, they sometimes will concede somewhat begrudgingly, well, it may provide symptomatic relief, it could even be dangerous and make you feel better, but it doesn't really get at the root of what's going on. I don't think you can get any deeper than gene, when you talk about turning on and off genes, that's very deep healing you're talking about. CBD and PPARs. This is a very interesting area. PPARs are receptors that sit on the surface of the nucleus of a cell. I should have mentioned, you know, what is a receptor? A cannabinoid receptor, it's a protein molecule that's embedded in the surface of the cell membrane that responds to biochemical cues in the body. Well, it turns out these different kinds of receptors exist on the surface of the nucleus, and CBD directly activates certain of these receptors. It's a whole family of receptors, these PPARs. So it raises a question, well, how does a substance get inside the cell? It's one thing if it triggers a reaction to a receptor on the surface of a membrane. How does it get inside the cell to activate a receptor on the nucleus? And the scientists have documented how all this works. There are transport mechanisms and so forth. I'm not going to go into all this. But what's interesting about these receptors on the surface of the nucleus, again, there's a whole family of them. And there's one particular one, PPAR gamma, that's called, that CBD directly activates. And one of its functions is involved in regulating gene expression. So it's one of the ways, it appears, that CBD is involved in regulating gene expression is by activating directly these PPARs. There's other ways as well, but that's one that's documented. So how CBD works. Okay. It turns out, and this might be a little confusing, but CBD itself has very little binding affinity to the cannabinoid receptors. Unlike THC, which directly binds the receptors in the brain and in the periphery, CBD doesn't directly activate these receptors. Instead, it interacts with the endocannabinoid system through various non-cannabinoid receptors, other receptors. A given cell has many different receptors on it. And it also it works through what scientists refer to as receptor-independent channels. There's ways that CBD affects human physiology that's not working through receptors. Any receptors. And one of the ways it does this is by suppressing an enzyme in the body that breaks down our own endocannabinoids. I'll talk about this a little bit more in a moment. But some examples of other receptors, non-cannabinoid receptors in the brain and the body that CBD binds with directly. Well, it binds directly with one particular serotonin receptor. It's called the 5-HT1A receptor. And this receptor is involved in many different physiological functions, including mood and appetite and sleep and nausea and pain and so forth. And by binding directly with this receptor, CBD will confer an antidepressant effect. You know, Prozac is based on elevating the levels of serotonin in the body. And if you activate certain serotonin receptors, it can have an antidepressant effect. And that's one reason why CBD acts as an antidepressant. And I didn't even include that among abstracts, among the many things that it appears to do. It also binds with the TRPV1 receptor. This is part of a family of receptors. They're called the vanilloid receptors, named after the vanilla bean. And this receptor, in particular receptor, is involved in modulating body temperature and pain perception and inflammation. And it's one of the reasons why marijuana that has CBD in it, unlike most strains which has very little, that the marijuana that has CBD in there, along with THC, is very effective for neuropathic pain. You know, neuropathic pain is a type of pain that opiates generally can't touch. But THC, because it activates the receptors, the CB2 receptor in the periphery, has a pain modulating effect. When it's combined with CBD, which also modulates this vanilloid receptor, it has a double effect for modulating pain. And that's why... Well, many medical marijuana patients report that just THC-dominant marijuana is good for peripheral nerve pain, and that's a kind of pain that's associated with diabetics, AIDS patients, cancer patients, rheumatoid arthritis patients have this neuropathic pain. But when CBD is also there in the plant in a significant amount, it's even more effective for neuropathic pain. Another receptor that CBD binds with is a particular adenosine receptor. Has various physiological functions. And another receptor that's quite interesting that scientists are still learning a lot about, GPR55. GPR stands for a G protein coupled receptor. They just have a number on it. It's not understood quite where it fits in the GPR55 receptor. It's considered what they call an orphan receptor. At one point, scientists thought, well, maybe it's a third cannabinoid receptor, but I don't think it really plays out that way. Well, CBD, there's a great deal of evidence that CBD binds to this receptor, and in so doing, it antagonizes. When a ligand, as it's called, binds to a receptor, it could activate the receptor or it could block the receptor, depending on what's going on. So CBD binds to GPR55, but it's an antagonist. And GPR55 is implicated in cancer cell proliferation. So if you antagonize that receptor, the idea you would be conferring an anti-cancer effect as well. So that might be another way that CBD potentially would be conferring an anti-cancer effect, not just through the ID1 gene silencing it, but through antagonizing GPR55. Now, this is a very interesting point about CBD. CBD is found to impede endocannabinoid degradation by inhibiting a certain enzyme called fatty acid amide hydrolase. FA is what the scientists refer to. And what this does, see, the endocannabinoids that naturally occur in our own body are created when they're needed, sort of on demand, and they exist for a very brief time. And then they're biosynthesized, and then they're broken down. And they're broken down, at least one of the main ones, the anandamide, which affects only the CB1 receptor, binds only to that. It's broken down by this particular enzyme. So if you have too much of this enzyme in your body for some reason, maybe genetically you were born with a gene that has a what they call a polymorphism or allele so the gene is encoded such a way so there's unusual amino acid repeat. It's kind of basically a mutation. So that results in you have greater levels of this FA in your body, then you will have less levels of this important endocannabinoid, and you'll have what is called a weak constitution, essentially. But what CBD does, remarkably, is it suppresses, it inhibits this enzyme. So what it means is by inhibiting this enzyme that breaks down our own cannabinoids in our brain, it means that our cannabinoid levels would stay higher for longer. And what scientists who are looking into this area found, essentially you have drug companies very, very interested in this. They create synthetic compounds that are found to inhibit FA, like CBD does, but these are synthetics that are specifically focusing on this aspect of what CBD does. Synthetic FA inhibitors, they're going through, there's a lot of interesting experiments done. And this is a few examples of what scientists have reported they found from working with synthetic FA inhibitors. They found, again, through preclinical work, that FA inhibition relieves experimentally induced colitis, lowers blood pressure of hypertensive rats, ameliorates neuropathic pain and arthritis in animal models, and blunts withdrawal symptoms in morphine-dependent mice. And you might think of it as like a house with various doors. You know, you can achieve all these effects simply by THC activating these receptors in our own bodies. That's sort of one door. It's a direct activation of receptors will produce these kind of results as well. But another way, in some ways it's almost a deeper kind of healing, is if you activate receptors by suppressing the enzyme that allows your own cannabinoids then to activate the receptors. And that's what CBD does. So in essence, you could say that CBD is a medicine that activates the medicine in our own bodies. And in a way, it's a more profound type of healing process than simply activating receptors directly through an exogenous compound. Not that there's anything wrong with that necessarily, but this is just a different mechanism. So I've been talking about CBD as a molecule. I want to talk for a few minutes now about CBD as a medicine. You know, if you go into a medical marijuana dispensary and you're looking to access CBD, you're not going to get a plate full of molecules. You will get either the plant itself, the plant matter, or you might get an extract or a topical or something with CBD in it. But CBD is not accessible as a single molecule to us. Laboratories work with it, but that's not what's out there now. CBD as a medicine comes as part of a plant, and the plant is a dialectical plant. In other words, it's a plant that has compounds in it that have opposite effects. Just like CBD and THC are opposed in terms of psychoactivity, that CBD will neutralize THC's psychoactivity. Well, at the same time, as we've heard, CBD can also enhance certain effects of THC, its pain-killing effect, its anti-cancer effect. So the relationship between CBD and THC is both opposition and synergy. It's kind of like a yin-yang. It's an interesting, complex relationship. Scientists have a phrase that I think sums up a very important aspect of all this. They call it the entourage effect. So the cannabis plant has many different compounds in it. It's thought over 100 cannabinoids. In addition to cannabinoids, all of which are biologically active, there are the terpenoids. That's what give the plant its smell, its unusual smell. They have flavonoids in the plant. There are some flavonoids that only exist in marijuana and nowhere else. And the flavonoids are what makes fruit have its skin color. You know, blueberries are blue because of flavonoids, you know, in the skin. And these are shown to have very potent antioxidant properties and so forth. Well, each of these compounds, the flavonoids, the terpenoids, the cannabinoids, each of them have their own particular medicinal properties. But when together, they act synergistically to confer a holistic entourage effect so that the therapeutic impact of the whole plant is greater than the sum of the parts. And that's the magic of medical marijuana. It's in the synergy. There is a pharmaceutical firm based in Great Britain that has produced a whole plant extract with equal amounts of CBD and THC. It's called Sativex. GW Pharmaceuticals produces it. It was first approved for use in Canada for spasticity and neuropathic pain for multiple sclerosis patients. It was later approved in the UK, and now it's approved in 20 other countries as well, but not in the United States. But clinical trials are going on here. I think it's now phase 3 clinical trials are quite advanced, testing Sativex, this CBD-THC combination, for cancer pain, a neuropathic pain for cancer patients. Sativex is an under-the-tongue spray. You spray it, you get a consistent dosage. It's clinically effective without causing any psychoactivity. And as I mentioned, it's available in many countries in around the world, and it may be available soon in the United States. Just a thought on this the business about psychoactivity, because, you know, the gold, what drug companies are trying to come up with is they're trying to create medicines based on cannabinoids that aren't psychoactive. The psychoactivity is defined as an adverse side effect, according to Big Pharma. You know, I wonder what they haven't been smoking, but that's the way they look at it, you know. And I thought this quote from Dr. Todd McCaria is a good one to consider when we're talking about psychoactivity and healing, because I don't see psychoactivity as something that's at loggerheads with healing. For many people, the psychoactivity is a pleasant thing, and they find that it's helpful for healing. It gives them a perspective on things that might be a little bit different. The euphoria is something a person in pain might want, you know. But many people don't like the experience of being high in marijuana. They try it, and they find it makes them anxious, maybe paranoid. It's not for everybody. But keeping this in mind, in terms of psychoactivity and healing, this is from Dr. Todd McCaria, whose role in terms of bringing back, restoring cannabis to the pharmacopoeia, as it were, it can't be overstated. Dr. Todd McCaria said, we should be thinking of cannabis as a medicine first that happens to have some psychoactive properties, as many medicines do, rather than as an intoxicant that happens to have a few therapeutic properties on the side. Kind of stands things on their head, and I like that quote. So the return of CBD. CBD was largely bred out of strains because when the homegrown phenomena took root in the United States late 70s, early 80s, when people started to grow marijuana in the United States rather than getting it mostly from Mexico or Colombia or from Jamaica perhaps, you had amateur horticulturists that started breeding the strains. And their idea was to make the different strains potent so that a person would get as high as possible. That's what they were after, because that's what they assumed, that's what people wanted. In so doing, they inadvertently bred out the CBD. They made strains that had less and less of it, because the more CBD was in the strains, the less high one would get. It wasn't intentional, but that's the way it happened. But serendipitously, some of what we call the CBD strains were rediscovered in California in 2009. When I say we, I'm referring to my colleague Fred Gardner, who is here today. Fred is the editor of O'Shaughnessy's. He was formerly an editor at Scientific American. And we were really the only two journalists who were consistently going to conferences of these scientists reporting their discoveries, not just with CBD, but many areas of this explosive area of science, the cannabinoid research area. And Fred and I would listen to these lectures, and particularly about CBD, which was emerging as the star of the show year after year. And we would shake our heads and say, wow, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if we actually had this stuff in California? You know, wouldn't that be good for people who needed it for medical purposes? And as part of covering the story of the medical marijuana movement, we learned about some of the labs that emerge. It's a niche industry as part of this multi-billion-dollar medical marijuana industry. There's many different aspects that are involved in it. And one of these labs that emerge to actually test the strains of marijuana. And it's rudimentary, but they could tell how much THC is in there and how much CBD, and that's pretty much what they were looking for. A lot of it was just to document how much THC is so that in the dispensaries they can put a number on it, and the higher the number, that's going to be better. And that's a really very simplistic, in some ways backward way of looking at marijuana from a medical perspective. But once in a while, lo and behold, they would come up, you know, one out of 500, one out of 1,000 strains tested, a little blip on the screen for CBD. And this was the first lab to emerge was Steep Hill in Oakland. It was backed by Harborside, which is the biggest medical marijuana dispensary in the United States. And we consulted with the people running these institutions, and we told them what we were learning about CBD. And we said, please, if you ever discover a strain with some CBD in it, would you let us know? And they let us know. And within a few months, we heard about half a dozen strains which had, well, we defined them as CBD rich, meaning I would put it this way, either equal amounts of CBD and THC or more CBD than THC. That's what we qualify as CBD rich. So at this point now, on the basis of those strains being discovered, and there are not a lot of them, you have all kinds of medicinal possibilities for CBD. You can get it in topical creams that you rub that are good for pain or actually good for a lot of other things as well. You can get it in the form of extracts or tinctures, or it could be baked into cookies and this way. So there's many different ways of accessing CBD now if you're a medical marijuana patient in California. Now, in 2010, Fred Gardner and I launched on the basis of the work that we were doing with O'Shaughnessy's, and Fred is the editor of that, and anybody who hasn't gotten a copy of the latest issue, we have it as a complimentary offering for everybody here. You should grab it. It's got a lot of, I mean, it's really the best journal for covering the science of cannabis therapeutics in a way that's accessible for the layperson. It's one thing to go to these conferences and hear scientists talk in this really obscure jargon that, you know, your head feels like steel wool after you listen to these people for a while. But, you know, they kind of tend to talk to each other. And the idea behind launching Project CBD was to have an educational service that would report to the medical marijuana community, to doctors, to patients, and to the general public about what the scientists were discovering. Just as we've been talking about CBD, CBD, again, is only one little slice of it. But the other side of it was to report back to the scientists who are kind of in their own world. They talk to each other, but they don't know what doctors are finding in California when they're working with medical marijuana, whether it's CBD rich or not. So the idea is to report back to the scientific world what the scientists and the patients are finding. And we work closely with the Society of Cannabis Clinicians, an organization that was launched by Dr. Todd Micaria before he passed away. And the SCC has begun a survey for patients who are working with CBD-rich strains to report on what they're experiencing. Are they getting any success at all? Is it great? How does it compare to this THC-dominant strains? So to bring it to a close now, CBD, I've talked about it as a very potent molecule with a lot of potential. We've talked about it as a medicine. It's also a myth-buster. What myths does it bust? It busts the myth that THC is equal to cannabis. It's only one part of it, a very important part of it, obviously, but it's not the only game in town. What other myth? The idea that single molecule pharmaceuticals are inherently superior to whole plant medicinals. Maybe they are superior in certain cases, but certainly not always. Key myth, medical marijuana is not just a front for stoners. Because if people are seeking out CBD that doesn't get you high, it shows that there's something going on here beyond people just simply wanting to get high. So I'm going to draw to a close. It's traditional that after the scientists make a presentation, they always thank all the people in the lab. And I do want to thank quickly certain people. Fred Gardner, Adrian Devitt Lee, my son, who's my go-to expert on science. Tiffany Devitt for helping to put together this slideshow and the Commonwealth Club. And finally, if you want to know more about CBD, there's Smoke Signals or there's various websites, smokesignalsthebook.com, projectcbd.org, and beyondthc.com. Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting. Let me remind the listening audience that you're listening to a recording of Martin A. Lee speaking at the Commonwealth Club of California on the topic Beyond THC, Cannabidiol and the Future of Medical Marijuana. And now we're open for questions, and you have to use a microphone so it'll be recorded. And I'll come through the audience, and whoever would like to have questions, I'll be happy to give you the microphone.
Is there any way to find out where you can get CBD tincture that is in some way more than the word of the person who grew it and has strained it to tell you what properties it has? Because I've discovered that each person who sells it has their own names for it, their own percentages, and make different claims.
It's a very good question. It's a question that at Project CBD we're asked very frequently from people all over the world, incidentally, emailing, where can they get this? There is now, just one example, there is a collective, and first of all, there's several sources. The important thing is that there should be measured doses so that if people are taking it and it's working for them, they can know what it is they're taking, how much is in there, and then they can repeat it. You know, that's it's reasonable to want that. There is one group called the Statewide Collective. Just as an example, I'll cite them. The Statewide Collective is not a dispensary, but they produce measured doses of CBD-rich extracts with very specific ratios. So you can get a 1-to-1 ratio, a 2-to-1 ratio CBD-THC, or a 4-to-1, or an 8-to-1. Or in reverse, you can get extracts with higher THC than CBD. And what some of the doctors that are working with this typically will do, particularly if a person is naive about marijuana, if it's an older person who's never used it or maybe used it once a long time ago or something, they're not going to get high. That's not what they're seeking. They'll start them on an extract that is CBD dominant with very little THC. But the THC is important. And over time, they will increase the amount of THC and up to where a person can no longer tolerate it, because too much THC is not a lot of fun. But you want as much in there as you can have, because it does have that effect of that synergistic effect. So Statewide Collective in California, you can go and Google it, and you'll find it on the web, and you can get access that way. You join it as you can become a member. They encourage people to grow it, the CBD-rich plants. You then grow it, and they will take the plant matter and make it into an extract. Anyone who grows a pound will get a liter back of the extract. And if you grow more than a pound, you don't want more than 1 liter, you get money from them instead. So that's one way of doing it.
My name is David Smith. I'm a physician specializing in addiction medicine, so my bias is towards the toxicity of the compound you're describing. There is widely used in the San Francisco Bay Area by young people and across the United States a compound sold as spice. It's a CB agonist that has a tremendous amount of toxicity, and the thing that they sell it as, it beats the urine screen. It doesn't come up positive on the THC urine screen. It's causing a huge problem amongst young people. Is this a CB1 agonist or a CB2 agonist?
It's a CB1 agonist. Did everyone hear the question? The spice, herbal incense. Fred and I have met the person that invented that. And that compound was invented. It's a very, very strong stimulator or activator of the CB1 receptor. It would mean a person will get very high from it. And the idea behind creating this was to study how the brain worked, to give it to animals, to radioactively tag it or something like it, and to figure things out, to learn more about the brain. And that's a very legitimate use. But when the formulas for these compounds are published, then anyone can get access to them, and then people can copy it and start making it. And to me, it underscores the importance of legalizing marijuana, because if it beats a drug test, then people who are in situations where they need to beat a drug test are more inclined to go to something like that. And it is potentially quite dangerous. And we hear of situations where the results of taking spice or related compounds are very unfortunate. So, yes, it's a CB1 agonist. It's a very powerful agonist. Remember the name of the guy from Clemson who created it? John Huffman, yes. He's been written about in yeah. Yeah. It wasn't just one Fred was talking about. There's several of these very potent CB1 agonists that are public information about what they actually are. And it's not just that one spice, but there's several others. Because then, you know, they get banned and then they have the other, you know, it's just impossible, the situation. And I think legalizing marijuana would go a long way toward addressing the problem of the abuse of these kinds of chemicals.
Hi. So you said before that that CBD inhibits the effects of THC. So if the percentage of THC is higher than CBD, then, or if the percentage of CBD is higher than THC, then you won't experience psychoactive activity.
That's a little bit too blunt way of putting it.
In
appropriate amounts, CBD can neutralize the psychoactive effects of THC. But it enhances some other therapeutic aspects of THC. So it's a complex relationship, and I don't consider psychoactivity to be non-therapeutic, although for some people it's very difficult to tolerate. Originally the plant had CBD and THC in relatively equal amounts. It's that we went through this strange process. Again, it's a lot of it has to do with prohibition starting in over the last 30, 40 years, you know. Hashish from India, Pakistan, Afghanistan has pretty much equal amounts of it, but hashish is a concentrate. It's the resin of the plant. And if you take a concentrate of a 1-to-1 ratio, you will experience psychoactivity. And a lot of it depends on an individual person's sensitivity. But if you have a CBD-rich ratio such that its CBD is way more than THC, you will experience very little or none at all.
My question actually is, does THC inhibit CBD as well?
Well, to the extent, it's a funny way of interesting. Yes, it's an obverse relationship. To the extent that CBD's non-psychoactivity is a property that can be inhibited, THC conceivably could do that. But it's a yin-yang relationship. It's not, it's not like you're sort of, stuffing something down. They work together, and the relationship is complex, and they do complement each other. But one of the kind of very interesting aspects of CBD, it allows people who otherwise would not avail themselves of the medicinal potential of marijuana to access that potential. Because if you're turned off by the feeling that marijuana creates, the THC-dominant marijuana, if you don't like that feeling, as many people are not comfortable with it, it just seems sort of capricious and arbitrary. That means, well, all the benefits of marijuana you can't benefit from because you don't like the feeling. So CBD kind of opens up the whole market, if you will, if you're looking at it from a marketing perspective.
Hi. I know that there is an attempt ongoing, was recently an attempt ongoing to reclassify or reschedule marijuana under the Controlled Substances Act so that it would not be Schedule 1, to essentially reclassify it as Schedule 2, 3, or 4 that would indicate it does have some accepted medical use, et cetera. As far as I know, that the petition was rejected, so I don't know if they're going to appeal it, but as of now, despite evidence being introduced for the first time in a couple decades of all of this research that had gone on since the last dump of evidence, the court decided that there was not a compelling case and marijuana was left as Schedule 1. Now, looking at the cavalcade of studies that you presented, it's hard to understand how that might have been the case. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that court case at all and as to whether any of this was included in the evidence presented to the court.
Well, I imagine preclinical studies were included as a part of the petition to reschedule marijuana. But it's a kind of a word game that gets played. Because there isn't a lot of clinical research, because it is restricted, and we do have a doctor in the audience, Dr. Donald Abrams, who heroically managed to jump through all the hoops and one of the few people that was able to actually do clinical research that showed marijuana's efficacy for pain and other conditions. But, you know, because there's a paucity of clinical studies on people, you know, that's how they can kind of get around it. And so these 20,000 studies that are preclinical, well, they don't count unless, you know, it's actually tried on people. And I mean, and there's some logical extent that, you know, it is important to know how it works on people, not just mice. But it's a weird decision, let's put it that way. And will it be appealed? I think it's when they're going to go through one. I don't know if it's run the course on this. It's part of the whole prohibitionist you know, apparatus here that's just very difficult to breach, but could collapse quite easily as well, given that it's really built on air. You know, it's not built on substantive science. You know, it should never have been prohibited in the first place. I mean, there was never any reason to. So, but to get it off the prohibition is proven to be much more difficult than it ought to be.
My name is Kathleen Pappas. I suffer from chronic pain, and as most people know, during pain management, you become tolerant to certain substance. And I've noticed it takes a while. Has there been any studies on GBD becoming tolerant with patients?
I think in general, cannabis, not just CBD, but THC as well, there's much less of a problem with tolerance. Donald, did you want to speak to that at all, that particular thing?
I don't think we have any information on CBD and tolerance to it because, you know, it hasn't been studied because mm-hmm. it's not available as a single agent. It is, but it's Schedule I, and so nobody's done that research. You know, the last study we did demonstrated that for people with chronic pain on opiates, that adding cannabis that was mainly THC to the opiates synergized so that despite no change in the blood level of the opiate, there was increased pain relief when cannabinoids were added to the mm-hmm. opiates.
Yes, my name is Charles O'Neill, and I have two questions. One has to do with the effects of marijuana on the brain of young people. Yeah, it's my understanding that it's adverse due to the fact that their brain cells have not fully developed until a certain age. And I witnessed that in some instances when I, as a teacher, am talking to, you know, young people in their teens and they're not comprehending. And then on the other hand, I see in the paper where Silicon Valley recommends it for the high-tech industry. So I'm kind of caught on that one.
It's a very controversial subject, that marijuana and young people. The average age where a person turns on or tries marijuana for the first time in the United States, it's to be 14 years and 10 months. And it's true that the brain is not full, you know. But I don't know. You know, I'm skeptical. It's not something I would encourage. There's other ways that people should recreate as young people. I mean, there was one study. I'll give you an example of the problems. Came out a few months ago from Duke University. It purported to show an association. It was later distorted in press accounts to be a causal relation between heavy marijuana smoking among young people and lower IQs later in life, that if you smoked marijuana heavily, you would have a drop in IQ of 8 to 10 points. And then there was a subsequent study published in the same journal that just came out recently that sought to debunk this study, and I think on solid grounds, because what this study that was done the latter by Norwegian scientists showed that when you take young people, particularly from an impoverished environment, and they're in school, it's a relatively enriched environment for them. And then you do an IQ test, measures them in an environment that is relatively speaking, compared to their rest of their life, enriched. you'll get a measurement, a certain level. And then later on, you do an IQ test for that person years later, and they're dealing in a situation where they're poor, they're in oftentimes people of color, and they're dealing with a very difficult environment with economically, socially, family life. And lo and behold, there's a measure of an IQ drop there. Well, the Norwegian scientist said this is perfectly understandable in terms of just the shift of environment having nothing to do with marijuana. And given what we know about the endocannabinoid system as a way of mediating stress, as playing a very important function in mediating stress and literally down-regulating stress hormones in the body, that if you come from a very stressful environment, an impoverished environment, well, you're more likely, if you're exposed to marijuana, to take it more often. But to attribute then the drop of IQ to the marijuana rather than to the stress or to the overall situation is quite misleading. So, you know, I'm very, very skeptical of that. And I think that for young people that are smoking a lot of marijuana, morning, noon, and night, it indicates that something is off. You know, something's wrong here. Maybe it's genetic. Maybe it has something to do with the levels of the endocannabinoids that are suppressed because of the kind of things I was talking about. But there's other ways to address this. I mean, like good diet, exercise. You know, these are things that also affect the endocannabinoid system in a positive way. Enhance endocannabinoid tone, as that's the phrase the scientists use. So, you know, when a young person is using marijuana a lot, I don't see necessarily the marijuana is the problem, but it's indicative of a problem. And there's other ways to deal with the problem rather than smoking marijuana. That's my take on it. But, you know, given what we know about, President Obama, heavy marijuana smoker. As a young person, it didn't seem to make him less intelligent, although sometimes I do wonder about his policies. But no, clearly he's a very bright man, and so it didn't seem to have a deleterious effect. And the fact of the matter, has never been a study that shows THC is toxic to the brain, that it actually damages brain cells. It's just the opposite of what the scientific research is showing, that it protects brain cells, that actually can promote neurogenesis, the creation of new brain cells, and that's what learning is. You know, that is connected to new brain cells being created. So I really am skeptical about the idea that marijuana hurts a young person in that way.
There's a Dr. William Courtney up north who advocates the use of raw marijuana ground up to make a juice with also the tears, the resin. And as much as 2 ounces of the raw buds mm-hmm. into this juice, and then as much as 1 gram of the resin. And this is being used for treatment of stage 4 melanoma. So I was wondering if you can comment on possible doses. And also the second part would be, if you wanted to buy plants that were high in CBD, how do you know for sure that you're getting those type of plants?
Well, the latter very quickly. There are certain strains. They do have names. And if they're being sold under those names, it should be high CBD. As for the juicing of the plant, the raw plant, there is an article actually I wrote in the current issue of O'Shaughnessy's that is a critique of the claims that are being made about juicing and how it allegedly works. I, for one, think it maybe does have a good effect. I don't know. But I'm very skeptical about the claims that are made about it. That doesn't hold up scientifically from what we could determine by looking into it. But it still might be helpful. I don't know. But I would encourage you to get the O'Shaughnessy's, grab a copy, and read what's said.
Our thanks to Martin Lee for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 110th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
I wanted to do that.
And the book is for sale in the library.